Blog Talk Radio.
Exploration into the world of Masonic Home Companion. I hope you're all doing well. Welcome back. And to those who are new to the Masonic woods that we wander through, I'm your host, Dale Graham, also known intemperately to my mother as Graham. And I'm looking forward to sharing the next few minutes with you to talk about things that are near and dear to the hearts of brethren. And let me send out a happy birthday, Canada, a little prematurely, but never prematurely. More and more of us are celebrating this great nation and proudly flying the flag. And we have gone through those crummy little days where the wags on television and the media would wonder out loud that Canada doesn't have personality and is unsure of itself. But they just never bothered speaking to people that had a sense of what was really going on in this country. We've never had questions. And particularly with this holiday celebration, it should be abundantly clear to the world and to every Canadian that we are well aware of the privilege it is to be a citizen of this country. We have privilege, but we work very hard. We anguish. We have a conscience. It's not like we're indifferent and we're saying the best. We're the best of the best. We struggle and we work hard just like everybody else to try and improve our situation. Let others claim to be the best. That's one of the smug satisfactions about being a Canadian. We hear all of these people proclaiming what they've done, and we tend to, I think, bite our lip and smile thoughtfully to each other, shrug our shoulders and say, "Are you daft? For God's sakes, don't tell anybody that we're laughing at them." It's good to be with you. This is the 30th of June, the 181st day of the year. And we have the annual communication coming up in Toronto, and preparations have been going on for months and months and months for that. A great turnout just to see that many fellows amassed in one spot with the business of the order at hand. It's it is a phenomenon you don't see in very many other places. I want to talk to you about how important Freemasonry is and remind you, I think, not in that self-serving or that obsequious, "Oh, gee, aren't we wonderful" kind of way. I tire of that. And I tire of hearing the same automatic phrases being used. I'm sorry, I know I was raised by wolves. I wasn't raised properly. I have some genetic defects. But bloody hell, how many hundreds of times do I have to hear the same phrase and then presume that it has any kind of sincerity? I'm sorry, I just like a little bit of independent thought behind it. If somebody's going to praise something, can it be from the individual instead of pulling out one of these stock phrases to use? It's like, have we been prepped like a parliamentary scrum? When asked this question, give this answer and don't deviate. I shake my head. I wouldn't care if a fellow stumbled to find the words. I would rather see that than all of these glib, thoughtless kinds of meanderings that go on. But that's me. I know I'm the only one in the room thinking that way. You're sitting back with your favorite glass of your favorite Kool-Aid right now. And remember, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. So when we're together, it's always a good time to sit back, put your hands behind your head, put your feet up, darken the room if you can, or just close your eyes and sit back and see if we can't solve the problems of the world and make sense of one another. And remember, today, you're not the only one that lives inside his own mind. Freemasonry is your opportunity to come out of that, living and struggling with your own guilt and conscience. Ain't what this is about. Ain't what it's about. We're about the antithesis of all of that. It sort of goes something like this. This is the famous Italian, 15th century Italian poet Dante Alighieri said, dear, worldly fame is but a breath of wind that blows now this way and now that, and changes name as it changes directions. He says, nature is the art of God. I can tend to like, I sort of warmed to the man when I read that. Small projects need much more help than great. Get it? We spend a lot of time fooling around with small ideas and putting a disproportionate amount of aggravation into ideas that mean very little. Issues that mean very little in the big picture. The things that are truly important, we try to suppress and ignore. O conscience, he says, upright and stainless, how bitter a sting to thee is a little fault. Oh, the older I get, the harder it is to admit, to not necessarily admit, but to acknowledge mistakes. But they seem to be more readily in front of me. Maybe it's because I'm trying to look at life now, between the points of the compasses. Where did that idea come from? It also says, from a little spark may burst a flame. Will cannot be quenched against its will. See, if we want to suppress ego, if we want to absorb the teachings of the three degrees, we're talking about will, we're talking about mind and personality and self. That whole bumper sticker, make a better man better. Well, man, it's not going to happen if you just clenched your teeth and you have to want it to happen. There you go. That's kind of an uncommonly interesting thought, isn't it? Oh, man. He says, he's the man that said, follow your own star. What a corny kind of guy. What a foolish man. He also said the secret to getting things done is to act. Pride, envy, avarice, these are the sparks have set on fire the hearts of all men. I wept not, so to stone within I grew. Keep it real. You're a human being. The sad souls of those who lived without blame and without praise. And he also said, little something to savor as you're sipping back that the nectar. The darkest places in hell are reserved for those who maintain their neutrality in times of moral crisis. Good man, huh? Oh, I've never met any of those. Yeah, no. That's it. Play it safe. Hey, it's Canada Day. And, you know, but Canada Day happened in a context. It was just a little bit. Work this into your conversation when you're sipping some lemon tea. I would say Canada is relatively young. Would you agree? So we make mistakes. We might be like teenagers running around. We'll get there, but you know, as a nation, we still have a lot to learn. In the year 1000, around there, the Vikings traveled and settled in Canada for Lonesome Meadows. Huh? 1496, on March 5th, King Henry VII of England granted Giacomo Cabotti the right, we call him John Cabot, the right to seek islands and countries of the heathen toward the west, east, and north, sailing under the English flag. Nice talk, Hank. Heathen? What are you calling heathen? On the next year, on May 2nd, Cabot took a ship that was called the Matthew across the Atlantic, and he was really looking for that that iconic Northwest Passage that, of course, is developed now because of the melt of the sea ice. And the we've talked about that before, the next extinction. Not that I'm hysterical. They were looking for a way to the Indies and China, and Cabot and his son Sebastian were the first Europeans to discover Canada, landing on the coast of Newfoundland, allegedly. 1534, Jacques Cartier discovered the Great Lakes and the... there you go. He didn't discover them. He was there, the Great Lakes and what was later called the St. Lawrence River. There were other men there first, I'm sorry, and probably met Jacques. So there's Jacques saying, hey, look what I discovered. But who was he talking to? All these other guys that were already living there for how many hundreds of years or thousands of years. Oh, yeah, you discovered it, all right, knucklehead. 1603. So is the Eurocentric colonialist notion of the world, right? I'm here, and all the rest are over there, so I discovered it. Yeah. 1603, Samuel de Champlain set sail for Quebec, and from Honfleur, France, following in the path of Jacques, of course, who, of course, he discovered Canada, didn't he? And then 2 years later, he created first colony in Port Royal. So that was like, it's worth coming back. And of course, I don't know if he was in love with the Canada the way you and I are, or whether he was in love with the fortune, because that was really what gave him the charter to go out, was this sense of investment. This was venture capitalists at work. It was just 1670 the Hudson's Bay Company was established, so we can see that venture capital was there. We could sell a lot of goods coming from the New World. As some friends tell me, you know, all the woods of Scotland have been cut down, the woods of England have been cut down. So where are you going to get any timbers to build anything, really? And this is before steel and aluminum and polymers. So you needed to get a lot of timber, and here we were. And still, you know, as much as we've tried to ruin it, to wreck it, it still grows. So I imagine some companies will come along and find a way to clear-cut the entire country and just make some profit, just like we've managed to find the, what do they call it, the tar sands. All about profit. Thousands of years of wreckage behind, but my goodness, it's magnificent profit that's being poured into the hands of 1672, New France expanded into Canada, and that was under Frontenac. A pretty interesting period. 1758, we were just sort of a glimmer, weren't we? There was some military lodges running around. French power in Canada declined that was the Battle of Louisbourg, or Louisbourg, depending on whether you're the French or the English. A friend of mine, Terry Crowley, Dr. Crowley, former chair of the Department of History at the University of Guelph, did his PhD on Fort Louisbourg. And so we'd have long, long conversations about it. It was full of great gossip around the development of the fort. And a year later, the Plains of Abraham, but it just battled it out, English and French. 1763, you can see there was a real scramble. And this wasn't always about hating my brother. This is about money. Huh? If I can get there first and lay claim and stake out my claim and protect it with some type of weaponry, then the riches were mine. In 1763, there was a Treaty of Paris, and the French colonies in North America were passed to the British Crown. Of course, the monarchs of in France, kings in France and England, were busy fighting with the Spanish and the Dutch, and there were battles going on with the Swedes, and so all of these campaigns cost money, as particularly if you're putting out for mercenaries. So, of course, you know, England didn't have the kind of power to, the king of England didn't have the kind of power to tax. They were nasty, but it was the French that just were spectacular. And we all know where that got them. You know, you annoy those folks long enough, you keep their heel on their neck long enough, and you live decadently and pretend as if everybody's going along with your despotism, and it will bite you every time. So in 1778, Cook came along the west coast of Canada. And then in 1791, the Constitutional Act established, ta-da, Upper and Lower Canada. Then, of course, we did kick the crap out of somebody in the War of 1812. I don't know, their name, I forget, just doesn't really matter. We won, that's all that's important. So, you know, Canada could have been quite different had the outcome been not what we had wanted. 1821, the Northwest Company was established. And then there was rebellion. Remember Upper and Lower Canada, 1837? There were still, you know, people agitating, trying to redefine the nation. Act of Union in 1840. And then the Fenian Raid and the Battle of Ridgeway in 1866. And, you know, maybe it's me, it's not that long ago. It's not like we're looking back 1,000 years in our own history. And then, of course, the 1867 Dominion of Canada was formed, and self-government was granted to Ontario, that was formerly Upper Canada, Quebec, formerly Lower Canada, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia. Those crazy Scots. There you go, four provinces. And then we had to have police just to keep an eye on everything. Didn't necessarily need soldiers running around, but police is often thought of as the best option, 1873. And then we needed to connect and travel back and forth. So that happened in 1885. They made a rail line to the West Coast. Then there was, you know, gold rushes and Boer War and the First World War. Nasty business. And then the world became very poor. Was that all about the stock market? We've just seemed to have gone through a lesson that, you know, we didn't really pick it up on the first go around. Only now we don't have the hindsight of knowing just how many people have been left destitute by what happened 8 years ago. We know it's bad. Then I don't want to talk about the war. It's too sad. Let's say thank you, boys and girls, for going over and doing what you had to do, giving us this chance today. Well done. There was a quiet revolution. This is a rise in 1960 of the Quebec separation sentiment. This really was when, you know, this notion that everything's happy, ha, 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 sort of fell by the way with a little bit of honest and frank conversation, where the idea of federalism in Canada was held to accounts. And it still is. And then, you know, sadly, we have the government throwing the army out at people in 1870 for what was something that would pass in a blink if we were in Ireland. In 1982, the Canadian Constitution was adopted. And you remember that along that way, Freemasonry appeared, didn't it? And it was a pretty cool period. We haven't been around that long. We fit in there, and we still exist. We should feel that we have a place, and but we came along with an already developed neighborhood. We stepped into a neighborhood that had already been developed. Grand Lodges in Europe certainly gave us a template how to go about doing what we had to do. But, you know, back and forth, they really didn't want to make it convenient for us, and we didn't have a strong champion at the strong champions in England to help us along. Notably, we were the first, weren't we, to sort of separate out and start off on our own. And we haven't been at it that long. It was only in 1813 that the moderns and ancients had reconciled. We came along even later than that. And anyway, you fellas can fill in the blank. You know when we started, and you've seen the evolution to this point. It's been relatively short. We must, I hope, be kind to ourselves, to each other, and it's not an excuse, but it's a reality. We're still building. We're still working on foundation. And when I look around, I don't see the Grand Lodge building with the Grand Lodge room that will hold hundreds and perhaps thousands of us. I see that we created, we're a very practical lot. We created what was necessary to get the work done. So we have offices that were necessary for the administration. And given the geography of this province, is it any wonder? Thank goodness we got to that. Huh? Anyway, welcome. Let's get on with something far more interesting. A little bit of history on this day, this weekend. I don't think it's going to harm you. So work all of that into the conversation. I want to talk to you about some observations. And I know I impose a great deal on you for advice. But what can I do? You can obviously tell I need as much advice as is available to me. And I never turn it down. You know, if you have an idea, it's obviously better than mine. I want to talk to you about how we pursue truths. Is that okay? Well, that's be the early part of things, and then we'll get into a little bit of philosophy. And there we go. That seemed to help. The way I'm putting this together today is that we seem to be always plunging toward the precipice of ignorance. Ignorance seems to have been a real problem for mankind over throughout history. Hindsight is full of incidents where ignorance causes a calamity and pain and suffering. But ignorance, in my frame of reference here, is like a point of no return, where we have no certainty and we're leaping into darkness. Hopefully, we will find an opening to the surface. You know. But we're always convinced that we have a goal in mind that's worth the risk, no matter what the cost. Can we honestly think that there was no risk in Scotland or Ireland or Germany or England when they were forming? Church and state were not yet constitutionally separated once upon a time. At no time was Freemasonry less complicated or less challenging than it is in the 21st century. Not like we came from a simpler period. It was different. Was the timing for a Grand Lodge just a coincidence, or was it a product of habeas corpus of 1640? We should punctuate our world with belief in angels and little people, but belief in coincidence only if we are well into our cups. So help me understand. You poor, and we'll talk here, of course. It goes without saying. We want to... we're doing things collectively, but I wondered about whether we could change the scale of how we approach complications. I'll come back to that in a little while. don't want to get into that right now. I have in front of me some material from Tobias Churton. Again, you've heard me mention that, but his work is so definitive, and there's an authenticity to it. I'm going through some of the Canterbury papers on Gnosticism, and I'm not quite, you know, comfortable enough or confident enough with the material to bring it on air, but we will get around to that when I can, perhaps toward the fall. I've talked about the de Saulnier and Anderson, and I've talked about the arrival of the Duke of Wharton. What we don't have is some of the anniversaries going on around the world. When symbols developed, when the square and compasses became icons, I think we'll need to dig out references, some research that's been done by one of her brethren on that. I think I've read a paper, might have been out of that, those fine scholars or Masonic students up in the Ottawa Valley. But I think we're going to be faced with a bit of a choice. We have a lot of really interesting work being created. Some of it is worth keeping. Some of it are opinion pieces of the time. But I find it remarkable. And I talked with Dr. Joy Porter, who you know was our keynote speaker at the Sankey lecture. And one of the points of the conversation was that we need desperately to start to organize these papers and this reference material. Right now in Ontario, it's just like we have thrown everything into a great big box and said, have at it. If you want to know something, it's in that box. Well, that box turned into a boxcar, turned into a Great Lake ship, and now the ship is full. Far too full, and we're generating a lot of information. There are some gold mines, there's some gold nuggets in there, but what we've done is, until we actually organize this chaos, we have left every single student that comes behind us, every single Mason, to wade through walk into this library of knowledge with no coding system, with no organization. And if he wants to find the material, he has to be prepared to go through every single scrap until he finds it. And what does he do behind it? Is he organizing as he goes along? Absolutely not. He's there to find his piece. So we're handling it as if it's a one-off process. To get ahead of things, I think it's reasonable to say we've redefined what's private. The illusion, the experience, the information never really was that private, but, you know, it was always out there in public. That's like saying there's not one of you listening that hasn't heard of a Mason bragging about how his wife helps him with the memory work. Well, you know, there you have it. It's not exactly private. Does this person go through the ritual? No. I don't mean to be unkind, but I don't think the work has ever been private. Mouth to ear, maybe once upon a time, but that day came and went a long time ago. And then we've had, you know, various people that couldn't, when they put their hand to an oath and they gave their word, couldn't do it. So they would spill. They would tell anybody with an ear if it made them feel that they were gaining some privilege by doing it, you know. Whistleblowers, WikiLeaks, way before WikiLeaks came around, and thought that they were, I'm sure, providing valuable insight, relaying secret information that would help make the community a safer place. Hmm. Now, so we've had that going on for a long period of time. We have this enormous amount of material. Not only is it, you know, chaos. Now, we couldn't, if I went into a district and said, you know, do you have a paper, you know, a definitive paper on symbolism in any of the lodges. You know, exactly. So we're getting older. Year by year, we're accumulating more and more information. And the pile of material is getting too large to ignore. So is this task. One day, we will be 200 years into the history. People 200 years from now, Masons 200 years from now, in 2313, will be looking at us, 22, 23, 25, hundreds of years ahead, are going to be looking for information about us. Most minute books don't really cut it. They sort of, you know, give the a boilerplate and not much context, not much character, and not much impression. So we'll be relying on our historians or Masons like you that write about a small episode. Now, those small episodes in your experience may be quite important in hindsight. Our students are going to have no real way of extracting that information or collating it or taking a look at a body of knowledge. Now, this served our purpose in the past when we have had so few pieces of information available to us. But Charles Sankey turned over a large amount, a large amount of materials to that are libraried properly, stored properly, and being cataloged and handled by professional librarians and archivists that know what they're doing. But honestly, if we walked into the Library of Congress, would all of his material even fill into one stack? We got away with it before because we didn't have that much. We didn't. And it was easy to go rooting through all of the boxes. Well, now we have, 547 lodges, storing all manners of bits and pieces. And there's places where, even if we say, you know, 8% of the Masons out there, 43,000, are reading in esoteric, in the fields of esoteric masonry or writing, and they're producing material. And we have, newsletters that are often written by the same people over and over, but that's not to suggest that there's a valuable garden of information that's being developed around us. We have no real way of knowing that. So let's say you have a particular interest in something and somebody on the other side of the province listening in has just found something definitive. How do we connect those two people? Well, I think we may not be able to connect the two people directly, but we can create pathways so that one can contribute and store in an organized way, and the other can retrieve it. By doing things in an organized way, we start to be able to allow for a greater amount of retrieval. We need to be able to make the work a little easier for the students coming behind us. Now, I think we need to also address the fact that we must add some, listen to me, must. We don't have to. But I think Masonic education deserves to be more than three-dimensional. Masonic education is designed, if it's effective, to meet a need. And I think the way it sits now, it meets more of a need, but it speaks to a particular grouping within Freemasonry. And it's one grouping amongst many. So in an ideal world where Dale's in charge, I know, I shudder to think, the price of a single malt will drop, the Leafs will win the Stanley Cup, and regularly, and we will have education set up to meet needs of, let's say, what I describe as operant and as well as speculative Masons. I know that we are all speculative, but I think within those two ideas are still alive with us. I think there are men that learn and want very practical tools to apply to their Masonic body of their Masonic thinking. And there are other fellows who equally, in an equally legitimate fashion, need to be able to reason through information for themselves. And I think that both of those kind of situations are legitimate, and not only legitimate, are critical to our growth. Not to say one is better than the other, that would be a bit foolish, but even then there are, you know, variations within people that want to be able to see the source material, do their own translations and come up and generate ideas, and the genius of people that will want information that's very practically geared to giving them what they need today. Do they need to know about it? It is a lofty question that I was asked by a Mason that I respect very deeply. So Tom asked me, you know, what is the need of, you know, why does a fellow need to have that bit of information? Well, you know, and I thought it was a very compelling kind of a question. It's in his mind. I can't define what his need is. And there it was sort of gobsmacked once again that we can redevelop education and so that it meets a variety of needs, all leading toward the same goal. More than one road leads to Rome. All roads lead to Rome. The overall goal needs to be what? Accommodating. And I don't mean that in terms of loss of control or the degradation of standard, that everybody should be at the highest aspects of academia. Anybody that's been working around people at the highest aspects of any type of profession will look around and say, not all of it is pure genius. A lot of the effort that gets there is based on a great deal of hard work, relentless effort, and hard work, So the information then has to be developed in practical terms so it's accessible to the person, to the particular student, so that they, not us, they can apply it to the questions and challenges in front of them. We, I think, perhaps sometimes make the mistake of trying to presume what people should know. And I think that's really the kind of determinism that leads to rack and ruin. But on the other hand, if you were a driving instructor and I'm sitting there 16 years old, uncertain about what's going on, there are certain skills that I do need to know to be so the rest of us are safe on the road. So in that way, you know, obviously we have to grant that there are some fundamental skills that are necessary for everybody. But there is also education that we want to present to people or make accessible to people so that they can do with it as they choose. Innovation. The problem solvers. Now, what's happened to the dialogue between, you know, and bear with me, I'm being quite clumsy when I say look at the operant Mason and look at the speculative Mason. And what's the problem with a dialogue between those two? Where in the world did we let this happen? It almost seems to me, and I'm only speaking for myself here, that there's a competition and anything operative is bad. Well, you know, I'm of Prince Edward Island. Wherever I am in the world, I'm still of Prince Edward Island, and of blacksmiths and farmers and fishermen. The sophistication has a different meaning there. Capability and skill mean something. Deals were still struck in my grandfather's time around my family with a handshake. And I remember land transactions, hearing about land transactions when I was a little boy. and the difficulty that the banks would have getting a legal and binding contract signed. And that came secondary to the grip. I gave you my word. The insult was, you don't trust me enough and you need to have a contract. This is a family stock. So if somebody comes along and tells me, you know, credentials is what creates honor, no. Or intelligence, hell no. Hell no. And I make no apology. This is how I've been taught. And I think the lesson has bearing. It's been repeated and reinforced many times as I've experienced life. So the form of it, we need to organize the material. My goodness, we're abandoning our own material to the humidity and temperatures of cardboard boxes, and while we brag about something sitting on a shelf, I mean, the old papers, the assets in the old papers are turning into dust. Well, blink, blink, it may not be a concern for you, but our great, great, great grandchildren are going to not be able to open the book. Yep, it'd be wise to digitalize all this material, wouldn't it? There you go. And do what with it? Preserve it. Preserve the knowledge. We cling to scraps from hundreds of years old, exposés done to embarrass Freemasonry. We cling to them to help us define what was going on, to help us understand what was going on in the past. Well, we have that passion to study it. We have that desire. It means something to us. The whole rest of the world could have access to it, but it has no meaning. Oh, if they want to, they can distort the meaning. But the true meaning of the material is geared for us, to us. Get it organized. Make it more accessible. Organization and cataloging and a retrieval system. Digitalization for preservation makes material more accessible. But not if we remain restrictive in how we present the ideas. This is what? Arrogance? Well, I don't know what you call it. You call it something kind. Just snobbery? I mean, my goodness. I shudder to think, you know, if we would kick Christopher Wren out of a lodge this day, if he came along. Oh, he doesn't speak the same language as the rest of us, and oh, he overspends, and oh my goodness, look at what he's able to create. Well, am I ranting too much, or is this beginning to make sense? And I'm not necessarily talking about, you want to feel wounded, you know, as Dante is pointing that we're making mistakes. Well, man, we're young, we're growing, we're figuring out, we're seeing problems, and when we do here in Canada, we fix them. And when we do in our Grand Lodge, we get to it and roll up our sleeves. And we will not stop, no matter how much the mocking or how much the criticism of our leadership. We cannot and will not stop until we find solutions. For those people that continue mockery and criticism, well, they can really be smug saying the solutions are so simple, they must be obvious. They're going to take small bits of effort woven together into great ideas that help us achieve our goals. In the meantime, the question that I always have for me and you and any other person that wears an apron, wears a Masonic apron, what have you done for the craft today? How have you shown support to our Grand Lodge? You put yourself in judgment of all of the efforts? Really? How many years and months and weeks have you spent studying, debating, collaborating, and then putting the ideas into writing? rewriting, critiquing, and then presenting it in a few simple sentences to an entire organization for approval. Man, that's harsh. What we had, the way we handle, the membership handles this. Oh, I know it's defensible. It's absolutely defensible, but man, it's harsh. It's wasteful. It's wasteful. Just like having all of this information sitting in this chaos, it's wasteful. And we waste the talents of really bright, dedicated, passionate Masons who are saying that form of learning is great for those fellows, but what about me? Well, I don't think that's selfish. I think, man, that resonates. That resonates. Some people like jazz, some people like country. Bad me, bad you, huh? You don't agree with the kind of music I have to listen to? Bad you. The thoughtful man can be sitting in a pasture, watching the sun come up with his animals in the morning. But which is the better man? Which is the bigger man? So we have work to do. I want to talk to you about changing the scope of our work. And again, I need your help here. I'm really pretty clueless in this. But it seems to me that we need to, I'm just a little, we've got some brilliant, brilliant ideas out there. Take a look at the, have you seen this strategic plan that's going on? That is a jaw dropper. It's good work to all of the boys. Let's say Grand Master and the Deputy Grand Master and the Management Committee and the Board. Nice work. Now we have to operationalize it. My father used to tell me stories. My dad was a tradesman too. And matter of fact, I was once upon a time too. Oh, yes. Got my hands dirty. Fingernails dirty too. Would say, you know, the engineers would come up with these plans, and they'd show them to the tradesmen, say, here, this is what we need to do. And the tradesmen instantly, you know, boys being boys, would look at them and identify what was feasible and what was never going to work. And when a few times they would, and it didn't take more than a couple of times before the boys learned the game, they would attempt to discuss the plans with the engineers. Of course, the piety of the well-educated meant that they couldn't take ideas and enter into a true dialogue with the tradesmen. And so the plans would be approved and be implemented. I can't tell you the, you know, truly, it was Schadenfreude. My father was the first living example of Schadenfreude. You know, that satisfaction at the suffering of others. Well, you know, when they had to, it spent a year and a half creating something, and it didn't match. The final units didn't fit together, and the entire thing had to be dismantled at the cost of what? X amount of time and X amount of dollars. Who do you think in the whole room were laughing behind their hats? Or smiling behind their hats? They didn't even say out loud, I told you so. They didn't mock. They didn't criticize. Do you think there was that glimmer of acknowledgement by the management, the planners, the designers? Do you think? One would like to hope, but history seems to teach that only a few would ever reach that level of insight. If you want to build anything, you need to sit down with your trades. You need to sit down and collaborate. The greatest architects in the world do it. What's wrong with you and I? The greatest leaders in the world do it. What's wrong with you and I? Collecting the body of expertise to dribble these pearls of wisdom to the unwashed? Really? Well, that's just an insult to a fraternal order. That is. That just doesn't belong. Doesn't belong. Contrary to our principles, contrary to our efforts, but Will the operatives in the room understand that? You darn right they will. The difference between what's well-intended and what's feasible. So we need some dialogue. We need some discussion. But not pointing fingers. It's like, let this whole process evolve. Let's take it up to the next level so that we can actually start to implement. Once we do that, gentlemen, once we have that kind of dialogue, if we have the chance of collectively investing in some of these projects, and if we go down in flames, well, we go down together. Oh, and how far down do you think we'll go before we'd catch ourselves and come up with another idea? We need to be able to mine the best brains within the order. And sometimes we need to be able to take calculated risks. So that means going outside of our own experience, moving beyond our own history. And what fear is there in that? Absolutely, what fear is there in that? Is there any? The more perfect a thing is, says Dante, the more susceptible to good and bad treatment it is. In the middle of the journey of our life, I came to myself within a dark wood where the straight way was lost. There. The more perfect a thing is. So we look for that perfect symmetry, like nature. The rules that govern nature are beautiful. They're beautiful. There's symmetry to those rules. You and I are part of that. But we also know that we're infallible. You know, we're not perfect, and we live in a world of probability. So these perfect ideas are susceptible to good and bad treatment. Yes. Yes. Brilliant. So take the ideas, but collectively. Grasp the observations. The dialogue we create is the inclusion. Every single Mason, every single one of us has a say, an opinion. Hopefully, some are more qualified than others, and we should pay very careful attention to those that are qualified. But if all our only measure of qualification is whether somebody's idea soothes my conscience or my ego, if that's the way we're looking at this, like leading with our egos, we're screwed. We're screwed. We don't have a whole lot going on. And I refuse to believe that that's the case. I do. So I'll come back to the idea of scale. I want to talk to you in the future about an idea, a bunch of ideas that have been happening around me. And I refer to them as nano masonry. We want to solve some of the complications that we have. The solutions, I think, are in, I don't know if it's nanotechnology, but it's nano Freemasonry. We start working on the problems at the smallest level. Yeah, somebody might be sitting there with their hands behind their head on their lawn chair on their porch with a big glass of iced tea, solving the problems of the world, but there's also somebody out in the field with a hammer and nails putting up the fence that was knocked down in the storm. And, you know, we can sit and contemplate about the theory of frictions and pressures that cause the tire in that car to be flat. And we may not be able to change that tire until we fully understand the physics of the event. But I'll bet you a nickel that there's some son of a gun with a wrench in his hand, hasn't got a clue about the laws of physics, but he knows how to change a tire when it's flat. Sometimes we are so full of ourselves that we're really foolish. So find yourself a group of artificers. Find yourself a group of architects. And what do you have to do to get them to talk? A few pints to loosen their tongues and get over their arrogance and stop with their pretensions. Both sides, we all have pretensions. and say, look, we're all in this together. We've all got an oar. We've all got a few buckets. If we don't bail, it's not going to sink, but it's going to be full of water and the effort's going to be much greater. We could make this a lot easier. Everyone that's ever paddled a canoe knows it. You paddle in coordination and sync, it's just heavenly. So, anyway, this is the kind of inspiration Canada Day brings to the Graham household here. Man, that's scary, isn't it? Anyway, there's, you know, I hope you've been committing a random acts of a sign of kindness. And include yourself in that. Include yourself in that. When you walk through the door, oh, and here's something I want you to think about. Help me with this. You know, I've been whining and complaining about the, you know, the need for balance between the three aspects of Freemasonry. Like, who am I, eh? And who were all those other writers that brought that up since 1723? Damn that James Anderson. You know, damn those guys. Anyway, you know, I've been noticing things. We on Masonic Home Companion, we've been noticing things. We notice that, you know, that balance sometimes is a little bit dodgy. Doesn't really happen. I can't believe that the notable Masons in history that we like to cite would give the place a second nod if their only draw of Freemasonry was to have fun. Be happy, have fun. Serious mind men, you want to attract serious minded people, mature minds, we gotta come up with something a little better than that. Oh my God, yeah, I know. I'm gonna burn for that one. But really, that's all we got? We're gonna be funny, we're gonna have happy. Well, I can have fun in my backyard. Give me a fishing rod and some flies and I'll be completely happy. Give me a nice opera and a long trip, and I'm good. Or a baseball game, or the company of some good Masons. I don't need the lodge to do that. Sorry, company of good companionship does it. Am I expecting that Masonry is filling that gap? Well, not so much. We do have fulfilled lives. We need to go a little bit beyond that. A little bit beyond, you know, a little bit. Do a little bit more and then happy. All right, I'm going to put you in front of the, I'm going to send you to the Louvre. And I'm going to say, now, find happiness in there. I'm going to send you to a museum. I'm going to send you to a garden. Find happiness. I'm going to send you to the end of a hard day's work where a whole bunch of guys have worked on something and have done it. Yeah, we had that feeling when I was in school. I would work framing houses, and you know, you get over the first couple of days where you're hitting your thumb and you have all kinds of black nails, and then the blisters turn into calluses. And you know how good it feels when you can stand back and lean on the truck and look, and there's what you guys built, and you see how the drywallers blasted in after you framed it. You see the shingles on and the plumbing in and the electrics all set up and even cupboards being installed. It's pretty good. Pretty good. And what? You have a gang of what? 4, 5, 7 guys? But that satisfaction? There you go. So, happiness? Yeah. Do I need that? I need something a little more when I come through the door. You want me to come back over and over and say I'm going to be stimulated? I need something a little more than wasting my time and having lodges that close at 11:30 instead of, or at 10:30 instead of 9:30. You want me to socialize? Well, give me a bit of time. You want to fool around for 45 minutes during degree work, watching somebody prance back to his chair instead of focusing on the candidate? Well, you're wasting time. I don't go to the play and watch the people behind the curtains. I want to see the central characters can bring the dialogue forward. But I sit there and watch the officers stop as if they're just been tasered, waiting for somebody to walk and square and sit down, and then somebody else stand up and walk like there is absolutely no anticipation. It is breathlessly boring. finish fast, get up, do your work, and let us get out. Screwing around and making the stupid jokes, you're not a comedian. If I want to see a comedian, I'll go see a comedian. You're wearing an apron, you're in a Masonic lodge, you're not a comedian, and you're not that funny. And we don't have to do it in drool fat. I know. Who's ever going to say this in a lodge? Nobody. Oh, geez, nobody. Who could cause what? Wrinkled faces and frowns? But you've thought it too. Oh, yes, you have. You've thought it too. You've been there. Don't be starting to tell me that I'm the only one on the planet. You know, it's hell when you start to think in truth, isn't it? What's Dante got to say about that? Oh, I won't say this. Consider your origins. You were not made to live as brutes, but to follow virtue and knowledge. Get with the program. We're Freemasons. It's what we do. It's what we are. Truth is, we can finish these. You want to see where this is done? Go over to Beaver Lodge. You want to see? 9:30. If that. Those boys are so considerate of everybody, including the candidate. But I want to ask you to do this. I want to think, is this so far-fetched? We screw around with guys, and there's still some clumsy guys that talk about, you know, livestock and silly. Like, oh, man. As if that wasn't boring enough at the end of the day. You know, it's still going on. Huck, yuck, yuck, yuck. Why not provide the fellow with a courtesy of explaining to him, giving him a moment of contemplation? Well, there's a novel thought that Freemasonry is, after all, contemplation. It's not a party. It's not a giggle. It's not like tossing the ball in the back air with a few fellas or throwing a frisbee around. Oh, we're in here to have fun. Maybe that's why we have a struggle with retention. You ever think? We go through so much degree work, measuring the success of a lodge in terms of how many, and in terms of our competition to be degree males. And I tell you, baby, we look around and how many noses are we counting of the fellows that have been initiated and passed and raised in the last 3 years? How many? It ain't working. So all I'm saying is we need to be able to step back and just take a little different approach. If we're not so caught up in the control of doing things exactly the way that it has been doing, no matter whether it's screwed or not. So I say to you, when a fellow is coming into lodge for the very first time, we teach him, we give him a moment of contemplation instead of putting our comedians out around him, sharing their lack of knowledge, glibly. We explain to the fellow that what he is going to step into is a room that is full of symbols. And a lot of the symbols have messages inside of messages. And he's not expected to understand them all when he steps through the door, but that it takes a few visits, many visits, in order to begin to understand what's being conveyed around us. To be able to collect his thoughts about this process of change. What are the important things in his life that he wants to maintain? And what are the things that he feels deeply that he would like to improve? Now, I don't think that should be disclosure, but I think he needs a moment, quiet moment, without somebody trying to, you know, interrupt his nervousness by their own nervousness, by projecting all over him, and give the fellow more of the Masonic experience before he's swept up as if this is a sort of a, you know, a dress-up version of the Kinsmen or the Lion. I love these other organizations, and don't get me wrong. As a member of Branch 6 of the Canadian Legion, I don't just talk the talk, I walk it. I think that these other organizations are essential. Also part of something that distinguishes Canada and Canadians. So, but what distinguishes us is that we have this great philosophy. And it may be the tradesman that interprets that philosophy As a matter of fact, some of the most profound statements I've ever heard have been from fellows that I would consider in my mind the artificers. They know how to get things done. Well, we don't want to listen to that because we have to reconfigure that into some kind of conceptual or theoretical framework. And I've been guilty of this on all sides. You know, you sit in the group, you sit there long enough, you get to see all kinds of wonderful things. Holy mackerel, it's just fabulous, isn't it? So think about this a little bit. When you're with the man coming through the door is not you. And truly, if you think this is all about giggling and having fun, you're really redefining us as competing with what? Putting down $15 and going to the movies? I have fun at the movies. Is that really the way you want to think about it? It's really the way you want to define our order? I don't think so. So stop it. Cut it out. Be kind to yourself. Make the change. Approach the fellow thoughtfully. You can have a good time over a glass of Kool-Aid later. There's time and a place. And oh, by the way, make the meeting stop at 9:30. Good grief. Your business, you know, get a cattle prod. Get the secretary to do his work and sit down instead of, you know, screwing around, searching for something. You know, anyway, shift gears with me. It's not that serious. It's not the end of the world. It's important. Get on with it. William Leslie. Great man. You know, we're trying to figure this guy out. I had to park Albert Pike. That Albert is just sometimes this kind of season, that's like, it's like talking with one of your boring aunts on a beautiful sunny day on the edge of a beach. I mean, you know you can do it, but boy, do you really want... Okay, so we'll park Albert for a while. We'll come back to him. I have some work to do on him toward the end of the summer. And I'm going to even break down... I want to put his... the strength of Pike, the ritualist that he is... in a different perspective, so I can handle. I was fine. I was putting myself to sleep. I was getting so boring, I wanted to slap myself there. I did. So this is from the graceful mind, the beautiful mind of Wilmshurst. The ordinary natural consciousness is directed outwards. Remember, you're not the only one that lives inside his own head, huh? Oh, you question and doubt and struggle and have anguish, worry, guilt drives you, your conscience bothers you. Come out of your head. Come out of it a little bit. Join the rest of us. We're all doing the same thing. We're all searching for answers. So here's him saying the ordinary natural consciousness is directed outwards. He's telling us that. Be ordinary. The ordinary natural consciousness perceives only outward objects. Thinks only of an outward deity, separate and away from us. It can accordingly cognize, you scamp Wilmhurst, it can accordingly cognize only means pick up shadows, images, and illusions. Now, who told this man that the world that we see philosophically is an illusion? Or that what we see as hard, permanent surfaces is at a molecular level in a state of constant movement? Well, again, the wrench in my hand may be molecularly in a constant movement, but I'm pretty damn sure it's going to take the lug nuts off that wheel so I can change that bloody tire and get where I need to go. Movement, yeah, but not now. Movement in a laboratory? Absolutely. Absolutely. Understanding the nature of the universe? Absolutely. So it can accordingly cognize shadows, images, and illusions, the impressions. The sciences of the mysteries directs that process must be reversed. It says, just as you have symbolically shut and closed tile the door of your lodge against all outsiders, So you must shut out all perception of outward images, all desire for external things and material welfare, and turn your consciousness and aspirations wholly inward. For the vital and immortal principle, the kingdom of heaven, is within you. I'm reminded here of the idea that the temple is really inside our minds, inside our heads. That the lodge is a representation of the mind. Think about that one. The impressions that we see through our eyes. We look around and do you experience boredom? Yeah. Frustration? Yeah. Wonderment? Imagination? Memory? Yeah. Are you influenced? Yeah. Do you always understand those processes? If you listen, if you pay attention? Yeah. Like the prodigal son in the parable, you have wandered away from it into a far country and lost all consciousness of it. Heaven is within you. You have come down and down as by a spiral motion or a winding staircase into this lower world and imperfect form of existence, coiling around you as you came interestingly thickening vestures, culminating in your outermost dense body of flesh, whilst your mentality has woven about you a veil after veil of illusory notions concerning your real nature and the nature of true life. You know, you want to have this conversation over a comfortable glass of wine, wouldn't you? And not where this competition, you know, that boyish, testosterone-driven, I'm the smartest, I know the most, good God, look at me, I have credentials, jeez. But where you can sort of catch your breath and connect. Freemasonry makes it easy for us, but you have to want it. Makes it easy for us to connect. Look for the Mason in the man. Now the time and the impulse have at last come to you to turn back to that inward world. Therefore, reverse your steps. Oh, he even tells us how. Look no longer outwards, but inwards. Go back up that same winding staircase. It will bring you to that center of life, that sanctum sanctorum from which you have wandered. There is a secret. Let somebody else in on that, and they will wonder and mutter, what in the world is Graham talking about? Well, I'm saying it out loud, the sanctum sanctorum. Oh, my goodness, what is it? Well, it's in here. You want to find out? Get in here with me. Or if you want to find out what his sanctum sanctorum is, go inside his mind. Or share the experience of masonry. What the palmist writes, who will go up to the hill of the Lord? Ah, there's a good Protestant for you. Even he that hath clean hands and a pure heart, the meaning is identical with what is implied in the ascent of the inwardly winding staircase of the second degree. Preliminary purification of the mind is essential to its rising to purer realms of being and loftier conscious states than it has been accustomed to. The secrets of nature and the principles of intellectual truth are to become revealed to its view as the degree intends and promises. The mentality must not be fettered by mundane interests or subject to disturbance by carnal passions. So this is really where we're told, you know, the compasses teach us to regulate our lives and actions, to limit our passions so that living, rising to eminence by merit, we can live respected and die regretted. This is where we have to be able to have a little bit of control over it. Now, I would suggest don't try and have this kind of conversation at every single lodge meeting. That would be kind of off-putting. Because, you know, you have to get into this. This isn't something you may, if you're a very contemplative fellow that day, you know, maybe you've lost somebody close to you. Maybe you can have that kind of focus, or maybe as you get a little older and practice it, you want to be in that kind of frame of mind more and more. But not everybody is. So give that little period of adjustment. Not every single, you know, lodge meeting should be conducted this way, but there also needs to be those moments where we provide the opportunity, and that's all we do. Don't be surprising or jumping on people with this. This is where you want to tell them, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have this kind of thoughtful, we're going to have a thoughtful discussion in a couple of months. And we'd like you all to be there, give it a little, so people can anticipate. You don't want to be there. It doesn't make you a bad person. You don't want to listen to somebody else drone on and hear their, because they like to listen to their own voice. It doesn't make you a bad person. And in fact, people like me would like to applaud you because you're contemplative. Your absence doesn't mean you've strayed. It may mean that, like most of us, we cannot process the most important ideas while we're sitting in an audience trying to be exploited or compelled by other people. You have to join the dots yourself. Most often, I think it's really important to do that in the company of somebody you trust. One of the characteristics of human nature is we do not disclose very much to people in authority. So keep that in mind. If the secrets of nature and the principles of intellectual truth are to become revealed to its view as the degree intends and promises, the mentality must not be fettered by mundane interests or subject to disturbance. If it is to contemplate its own intellectual faculties and trace them from their development until they are found to lead to the throne of God himself and to be rooted in deity, it must discard all its former thought habits, prejudices, and preconceptions and be prepared to receive humbly the illumination that will flood into it from the light of divine wisdom. Really, Wilmshurst is telling us that this is the second degree is the preparation for what's coming when you're raised to the sublime degree. We would expect that the first demonstrates the death of self and the rebirth, the death of ego and the rebirth as a Mason, open and receptive, an admission, I know nothing, I come in ignorance. And here we're saying, get over yourself, get over yourself. Have you done that yet? Driven by the same ego that drove you before you became a Mason? Really? You have to be receptive. Freemasonry and the ideas are gentle. This is the gentle craft. They're not going to be able to blow through your armor like armor piercing something or other. It's not intended to be that way. That's not the way Freemasonry works. It's like, did the light go on? Did you start to look around and say, time is passing me by. I want to know if I can do something meaningful with it. There you go. For the determined student of the mental discipline applied by the second degree, there may be recommended two most instructive sources of information and examples of personal experience. One is the dialogues of Plato and the writings of Plotinus, and the other Neoplatonists. The other is the records of the classical Christian contemplatives Erhard or Ruzebrock, or the interior castle of Saint Teresa. The Phaedrus of Plato, in particular, is an important record by an initiate of the ancient mysteries of the psychological experiences referred to in the Fellowcraft degree. Doesn't mean you have to turn to Plato to understand. You know, there's lots of different ways of understanding the psychological meaning of the second degree. But even the artifice recognize there's a lot going on, and some of it is affecting the individual, and that's the inner process of the individual is what we call the psychological makeup. It happens inside of you and me. It's like when we look at the surface, I don't see your heart beating and you don't see it, but it does. We may be very practical people needing to take care of our tasks and duties throughout the day, but we also have a mind, imagination, memory, capacity to recall, hope, faith, you know. So do we progress? Absolutely. Now, I've given us that's as much as I want to talk about today. When you stop with the Phaedrus of Plato, what you want is for we should be able to say what in the world that means in practical terms. I mean, Plato would. That's the genius. You see, we can read the workings of very, very bright people, but it doesn't necessarily mean we have an ability to translate all of this. It's hard. It's darn hard. And it takes a great deal of thought and somebody with a great deal of confidence to say it out loud. Now, I'm only going to leave you. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you for your support. We teeter somewhere between 1,000 and 3,000 listeners. Not bad for a weekly, I would say. And thank you very much for. I think that means that this must be serving some kind of need. So I'm more than pleased at that. Want to leave you with something you can work into your conversation over the barbecue pit today. When you've brought home the sustenance for your family, you've been out hunting for days, you've knocked it over the head, you've slung it over the shoulder, and you've dragged it into the backyard, and you're ready to carve it up and throw it on the barbecue. Whether you're throwing on chunks of tofu or you've got something that's still kicking and mooing. I want you to have something a little bit, thoughtful. After all, you are me. So here's your task. I'm going to leave you with a little bit on ethics, okay? I want you to think about not hedonism. That's too much fun. I think, yes, we will need you. This is a holiday. Hedonism is this is part of an ethical consideration. Workmen and scientists alike, there you go. Hedonism posits that the principal ethic, what drives you and me, the right thing is maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. I hope all of you in some way are hedonists. There were several schools of hedonist thought, ranging from those advocating the indulgence of even momentary desire to those teaching a pursuit of spiritual bliss. Well, it depends how you're going to approach it, eh? The Cyrenaic hedonist has that eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die attitude. This was found by Aristippus of Cyrene, and that was eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we may die. Really? There's nothing more. So, there are always different states of ethics. We have pragmatic ethics, and this is an ethic that holds that the moral correctness evolves similarly to scientific knowledge. Socially over the course of many lifetimes. Thus, we should prioritize social reform over attempts to account for consequences, individual virtue, or duty. So we focus on reform rather than attempting to explain individual virtue or duty. That's the work of Charles Saunders Pierce and William James. Then there's role ethics. This is a type of ethics, the people that believe in this have a sense that role ethics is an ethical theory based on family roles. Unlike virtue ethics, role ethics is not individualistic. Morality is derived from a person's relationship with their community. Confucian ethics is an example of role ethics. Confucian roles center around the concept of filial piety, a respect for family members. And then we have postmodern ethics. Before you get all scrunchy about this, things did move forward and our ideas have moved forward. Just because we don't read all of this stuff, it's like art has moved forward, it's different than it was. 20th century saw a remarkable expansion and evolution of critical theory following on Marxist theory. Efforts to locate individuals. And Marx, an interesting Jewish guy, obviously an intellectual, his ideas have generally been exploited and distorted. Much more fun to listen to the sort of read the headline banners of the trash newspapers than to actually open up some of his work and see what he really said. Just like Darwin, you know, what did he really said? It's different. What he really said is different than the exploitation. It took. So the lately we've come up things called anti-humanists. And they've challenged the possibilities of individual agency and the coherence of the notion of the individual self. A critical theory developed in the later 20th century, post-structuralism, sought to problematize human relationships to knowledge and objective reality. Well, that's a very simple deal. I ought to be able to work that into a conversation. Have you lost your mind, boy? That's enough of that. Sorry. So when anybody asks you about ethics, say, you know, I really need to have a particular mindset. You know, I need to be able to approach that gradually because it's so deep. Can I get back to you on that? In the meantime, before I go, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you for listening to the rants. I hope you can help me with some of this. I mean, really, I've got it. You know, this is unexplainable for me. I can't do this stuff alone. I'm a Freemason. I'm going to leave you with a little piece from 1923, Nobles of the Mystic Shrine. Commit as many acts of random kindness as you can. Play hard on Canada Day. Happy birthday, Canada. See you next week.